Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The post-Hurricane Michael disaster that is so much of Northwest Florida is leaving more and more broken lives in its wake.
I mean, I don't know what else to tell them besides we had to move.
Also tonight, we'll assess the storm's ongoing impact on the region's basic infrastructure.
When we realized that it was the AT&T network that was still up and running, we were able to source phones that worked on T-Mobile or AT&T networks.
In addition, we'll talk about the ongoing debate over whether or not to arm school teachers, and we'll tee up the upcoming budget talks between the Florida House and Senate. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the end of week five, with four more scheduled weeks in the 2019 Florida legislative session. Welcome to Capitol Report. Housing is scarce and evictions in the Florida panhandle are on the rise, leaving many with nowhere to go. Robbie Gaffney visited one of the hardest hit areas.
In the small city of Port St. Joe, neighborhoods are mostly cleared of debris, but families like the Hodges are still feeling the effects. The Hodges family has rented a three-bedroom house for almost 3 years, but after being ordered an eviction, they can't find a place for a family of seven.
Nobody's renting nothing out.
This is Shaquita Hodges, mother of the family.
It's basically like this. If you come back home and your house wasn't destroyed, you was blessed.
The house Hodges was renting had minor structural damage from Hurricane Michael, but mold from rainwater made one of the rooms unlivable. In the last week of March, Hodges had to tell her children to pack up for good.
I mean, I don't know what else to tell them besides we had to move and had to split them up between my brother and my uncle, and then me and my husband and my baby boy had to find somewhere to stay until we relocate somewhere. It's gonna be hard.
Hodges' story is part of a larger housing epidemic that stretches across the panhandle. Bay County Superintendent of Schools Bill Hussfeldt said in March that 73% of apartment housing in the area was uninhabitable.
Evictions are starting in housing that people should not be living in, but they're living in it because there's nowhere else to live. And again, that's one of our major problems.
Hussfeldt says he's had to close down schools due to the shifting population.
We have a lot of teachers and administrators that have lost their homes and support personnel. We have a lot of staff that have, I've got one staff member that has moved seven times since the storm.
The housing crisis is even stalling efforts to rebuild the healthcare community. Gulf Coast Regional Medical Center's Brad Griffin says housing is a major concern when recruiting new employees.
You know, having an adequate housing market is going to be very important to them as well. So I think there's an impact with that. Also, because of the way that the housing is currently, you know, it's going to be a while for the population to rebuild, and therefore there to continue to be a growing demand for healthcare services.
Legal Service of North Florida sent workers to evaluate the situation back in October, which is when Scott Mannion noticed an eviction crisis.
But what's happening to many people is, I talked to a lady, she's in her apartment, it's her and her granddaughter is 2 years old, and the windows are gone, there's a hole in the roof, there's the carpets are sopping wet, there's mold.
She'd been asked to leave, but Mannion told her she didn't have to. He says tenants have protections to prevent eviction after a disaster.
When a person has a written lease, when they have paid their rent, you know, they're, you know, the right to terminate the lease when there's a disaster in the Landlord-Tenant Act is with the tenant.
But tenants like Hodges aren't so lucky. After a long battle with her property owner, Hodges is now living with a friend, and her children are sleeping under different roofs. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
When Hurricane Michael swept through North Florida and the Panhandle, it took out more than just buildings and utilities. The region's health care system was nearly crippled. Lynn Hatter speaks with Gulf Coast Regional Medical Center CEO Brad Griffin about weathering the storm and coming up with contingency plans.
You know, we set to work right away, rebuilding the hospital and trying to restore services as quickly as possible. And within 30 days after the storm, we had completed a partial reopening, so we were able to restore beyond. We kept the emergency room open the whole time, of course, but we were able to reopen some inpatient services and operating room capability within 30 days after the storm, and then within 90 days after the storm, we were able to open 100% of our inpatient services that we had available to us pre-storm. So today, things are even better. We're certainly still in the rebuilding phase and have a lot of work in front of us to do, but we're well on our way.
What lessons have you all learned following Hurricane Michael? Did you all evacuate patients before the storm? And, you know, how have some of these experiences sort of informed your emergency planning for future storms?
A lot of our lessons learned, I feel like we did a pretty good job ahead of the storm. We did some evacuations, but quite honestly, this storm developed so quickly that there wasn't enough time to evacuate more than we did ahead of the storm. Every storm is different, you know, and this one developed rapidly late in the game to us. So we had reached a point where we could not evacuate anymore. So it became down to preparing for what was coming at us. Our lessons learned for us are going to focus on kind of after the storm. I don't know that caught us off guard is the right, but that required some additional maneuvering.
Well, what was that thing?
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple of examples. First thing is that we anticipated the loss of utilities, okay? So we had a plan for our power and our water and our sewer after the storm. We had generators here that would power the entire hospital. We had water tanker trucks that were on site ready to connect to the hospital when we lost that. We had generators prepared for our lift stations and our sewer. Our air conditioner, this will be a real specific example. So our air conditioning system at the hospital is a water-cooled system. The plan was that when we lost city water, that we would convert it to a well that is on site to keep water running through the air conditioner. We had power, actually had two very large generators on site. In case one failed, we had a backup to that. But so when we lost water pressure, the plan was to switch it over to the well to keep water running through the air conditioner. Well, the severity of the storm blew the well away during the storm, and we did not have an immediate contingency for the well. And so we were without air conditioning for about 8 to 10 hours after the storm until we could put together the parts and pieces to get the well back in shape and get water to the air conditioner. So it was almost like we had a contingency plan for our plan, but we needed a contingency for our contingency plan. And so that was one example of it. The other was the communications. We were prepared in that we had satellite phones in the building. We had some walkie-talkies available. I don't think we anticipated losing the Verizon cellular network in the way that we did. And so while the satellite phones and the walkie-talkies were good kind of short-term solutions, the satellite phones don't work inside the building and the walkie-talkies don't work outside the building. So it took us a day or two to figure out how to source these additional burner phones and get them here. And so maybe being a little bit better prepared around communications was a lesson learned.
How did you guys get around that? You said you used burner phones?
We did. We so when we determined, when we realized that it was the AT&T network that was still up and running, we were able to source what we called them burner phones, but they were phones that worked on T-Mobile or AT&T networks and had them shipped in to us so we could distribute to our leadership and communicate with each other.
When you're telling this story, what do you tell people about going through this experience?
Sure. You know, I would just tell folks that this sometimes get lost. I'm so proud of the team here at the hospital. The nurses, the techs, all the staff, the physicians, and how committed they are to taking care of patients in the community. It was, you know, several days after the storm before most of the staff in the hospital were able to get out and go check on their personal situation, because we were here taking care of our patients and, you know, planning for the next steps. And sometimes folks, and this goes for the whole first responder community in addition to just hospitals, but, you know, sometimes it gets lost in the storytelling that there's some real true hero people, true heroes in this industry that we work in, that are here, you know, taking care of the patients and taking care of the community, even in the face of the disaster. And, you know, the team here performed above the call of duty and just really did a great job, and couldn't be more proud of them.
That was Gulf Coast Regional Medical Center CEO Brad Griffin. He was interviewed by Lynn Hatter. Still to come on Capitol Report, now that we've heard about so many of the issues facing storm-tossed Northwest Florida, how is the Florida legislature responding to the crisis? And what about the feds?
And that devastation is long-term. We're on the verge of some serious, serious problems in North Florida if we don't get the federal help that this state deserves.
The Capitol Report Reporters Roundtable talks about the budget and abortion.
The House is proposing across-the-board cuts to Medicaid reimbursements to hospitals by upwards of $100 million.
Legislation that would allow classroom teachers to bear arms has been making its way through both chambers, and some opponents believe putting more guns in school will increase the risk.
Army teachers who are on the clock to teach, not in protection attack mode, place us and our students at increased risk of being killed.
And someday soon, cars could be navigating Florida highways with no steering wheels or pedals. Lawmakers say now is the time to prepare.
The great opportunity of a state that doesn't have snow, a DOT that has great lane lines, and a growing marketplace of Florida that has 21 million people moving to 26 million people by 2030.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
During the first part of tonight's Capitol Report, we heard about lots of lingering issues facing the state's Northwest Quadrant, but will there be enough money to pay for the recovery? A push for Hurricane Michael relief funding is underway in the Florida Capitol. Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried toured hurricane damage in Calhoun County as state leaders are asking for federal funding in the Big Bend. Kevin Del Orbe reports.
On the heels of President Trump announcing he will grant Florida almost $10 million for Hurricane Michael disaster relief, Commissioner Nikki Fried says the situation in the Big Bend is growing more urgent.
The fire last week that we saw in Bay County should have been 5 acres, a few hours to put out. But because of all of the fuel that is on the ground, it took until today to have 100% detained in over 668 acres. This is what we are going to be experiencing. As we have heard on numerous times before, is that the fires that we saw in California will not pale into comparison to what we could see here in our state.
Making landfall last October, Hurricane Michael left almost 72 million tons of trees on the ground, posing a major threat of wildfire. Fried is pleading for more funding from the federal government to help with costs of cleanup.
The debris removal must come now. This debate is over. The time to debate this is over. The U.S. House passed a piece of legislation 6 months ago to get disaster relief. Again, this is not bipartisan. This is something that we must do as a collective unit. We need Congress to care and to step up and to do their job.
Senator Bill Montfort toured Calhoun County with Commissioner Freed.
Again, and when you see it firsthand, you can see what you can't see in pictures or you can't describe in words. It's a total devastation in so many different ways. And that devastation is long term. We're on the verge of some serious, serious problems in North Florida if we don't get the federal help that this state deserves.
Negotiations are set to start as the House and Senate pass their proposed budgets, with a difference of about $4 million. I'm Kevin DeLorbe.
We are on the downhill slide, the end of week five of the nine-week Florida legislative session, and we seem to be right on track for a number of major considerations, the only one that really counts constitutionally being the putting together of a new state budget. Ryan Daly joins us on Capitol Report first for that, and we finally got to kind of, sort of, maybe similar budgets from House and Senate. Ryan, how did this come out this week?
Yeah, similar in some ways and differing in many ways. Both chambers have passed their budget proposals, as you said. So the stage is set for the budget conference, getting both chambers together to hopefully get things to meet in the middle. Starting with healthcare, the Senate's healthcare spending, as it is in a number of budget silos, is more robust than the House. But the big difference comes from funding for hospitals. The House is proposing across-the-board cuts to Medicaid reimbursements to hospitals by upwards of $100 million. Schools. The Senate is, again, spending more robustly on schools, increasing the public schools funding mechanism by $1.1 billion. One notable difference between the House and Senate approach to education. The House this year doesn't have an increase in safe schools funding or mental health allocation compared to last year. That is in contrast to the Senate that in both of those areas, safe school and mental health allocations, is proposing upwards of 40% increases to both. And higher education, the House is making some cuts to the university system. The Senate is not. For affordable housing programs geared toward the panhandle for Hurricane Michael recovery, I think some of the handful of no votes that you saw on the House budget that I think all came from Democrats can be attributed to that. Central Florida legislators and elsewhere that feel that targeted funding for Hurricane Michael recovery kind of leaves them out. I know Orlando, I believe, atop the nation in affordable housing problems. So that's going to all those things together are going to prove interesting, how some of those negotiations go during the budget conference.
Well, if that is not controversial enough for you, we can always go to something like abortion. Sean Mulcahy, that's what you've been following this week.
We have a couple different measures that are moving through both chambers. The one that has the most momentum right now is a measure that would add parental consent requirements for any minor seeking an abortion. So the way the law currently situated is that any minor that wants to have an abortion has to get parental notification. That means that they have to sign a piece of paper with their parent acknowledging that they are aware that their minor is getting an abortion. This law would change that to require any minor that wants an abortion to get their parent's permission. And why this is controversial is because, the only way around this, if a minor wants to get around that parental consent, it requirement is to go to a judge and petition it. And basically what's that leaving it up to do is it's leaving up the judge to rule whether or not the minor is mature enough to have an abortion. Advocates say, this is preserving family values and it's keeping parents in the conversation. But opponents, on the other hand, worry that if a judge rules that a minor is too immature to have an abortion, yet they're still mature enough to raise a child. So that's a big conflict there. And this bill is kind of on the fast track. It's moved through two House committees. It's on to its last, and the Senate is about to pick up its version.
A lot to keep an eye on over the next 4 weeks, because that's all we have left in this session. Sean Mulcahy watching the abortion issue in the Florida legislature, and Ryan Daly right on top of all the budget negotiations yet to come. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
More than a year after the Parkland School massacre, a comprehensive response on how to best prevent a future tragedy remains a work in progress. For many, the question boils down to this: are parents comfortable with placing their children's safety in the hands of an armed teacher who has 8 hours of active shooter training? Blaise Ganey reports.
Are they prepared to deal with collateral damage? Because it's going to happen. Law enforcement, bystanders get killed by guns from law enforcement all the time. The way that we can live with it is that they're trained.
That's Wakulla County School Superintendent Robert Pierce. He doesn't believe arming teachers is the answer.
These people are going to get 138 hours of weapons training and tactical training, and heaven forbid they accidentally shoot an innocent bystander. Are we going to have the same reaction to when that happens for that teacher and the weapon? Those are the questions that are not being talked about by lawmakers, but they need to be answered.
In Wakulla County, Pierce says school resource officers are armed with semi-automatic rifles. He says in their county, this was widely accepted.
Wakulla County is a red county. Most of the people that live here are card-carrying NRA members, and so weapons and guns don't typically shock the majority of our public. Never was approached about any concern over placing those weapons on our campus as long as they were in the hands of a licensed law enforcement officer, which all of ours are.
But not every county is like Wakulla. Greta Patenaud is an ESOL teacher in Tampa. She told lawmakers in the House Education Committee she wants a bigger focus on other ways to prevent crimes.
Please look into technology, building infrastructure to mitigate risk. Bulletproof glass, auto-locking doors, smart badges, these are all ideas for my students. Army teachers who are on the clock to teach, not in protection attack mode, place us and our students at increased risk of being killed.
And Patenaud says that's not the only reason teachers shouldn't be armed.
But I don't want the other teachers looking at my black, brown, Muslim students, whatever other is, and they're not constantly being trained for this.
That drew a response from Palm Bay Republican Representative Randy Fine.
I just want to make sure I understand. Are you stating here publicly that you believe that the other teachers that you work with are racist, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, because you've got students of different backgrounds in your classroom and as a result they can't be trusted? I just want to make sure we understand that on the record.
I think that exists in every population.
Thank
whether
you.
Or not it's in a cafeteria or on a bus or anywhere, that's just part of society. And I want the people who are trained in that situation on a constant basis to be able to make these difficult decisions.
Thank you. I think a little better of teachers.
Representative Byrd, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. And Representative Fine asked my question that for the speaker to point out the racist colleagues she has, because I'm not aware of any teachers that I know that exhibit those racist behaviors.
That was Jacksonville Republican Representative Cord Byrd. He says he hasn't heard of racist teachers. But Lisa Weindorf is a former music teacher at Dinsmore Elementary School in Jacksonville. Weindorf's contract was not renewed for the 2018-19 school year after a district investigation found she used the N-word and played slave games in class. She isn't alone, though. Several teachers in Jacksonville over the past few years have made news headlines for racist conduct, and that kind of behavior isn't limited to Jacksonville. Despite concerns, the legislation is moving forward. In the House, the bill is ready for a floor discussion. Lawmakers postponed it Wednesday, but are expected to take it up again. Meanwhile, the Senate version is heading to its last committee stop. I'm Blaise Ganey.
Gina Jordan hits the expected highlights coming up at the Capitol for Week 6.
Looking ahead to next week, a parental consent bill for minors seeking an abortion gets its first committee hearing in the Senate. A similar proposal is already moving through House committees. Information on the dangers and signs of human trafficking may become a required part of public school health curriculum. The safety of religious institutions gets another hearing. Entities like churches and religious private schools could authorize someone who has a concealed firearm license to carry that weapon on campus. Medication prescribers may soon have to generate and transmit all prescriptions electronically, except during times of temporary electrical or technical problems. A Senate committee will hear a presentation on suicide prevention and consider changes to child welfare laws to ensure compliance with federal regulations. Another Senate committee takes up a bill regarding voting rights restoration to conform to the state constitution. This would implement the felon voting rights amendment passed by voters last November. That's some of what's ahead at the Capitol. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, lawmakers are considering new legislation they say could set Florida up as the epicenter for testing and creating autonomous vehicles. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
There are plenty of reasons for autonomous vehicle companies to come to Florida, says St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis.
The great opportunity of a state that doesn't have snow, a DOT that has great lane lines, and a growing marketplace of Florida that has 21 million people moving to 26 million people.
Brandis has a bill he says will help clear the way for more autonomous vehicle growth.
This bill continues to keep Florida on the forefront of technology. We revise certain requirements to comply with federal regulations. We provide that a human operator is not required to operate a fully autonomous vehicle, regardless of a person's present in the vehicle.
An amendment to the bill also includes specific insurance requirements, especially for network transportation companies like Uber and Lyft.
Really, this bill focuses on definitions, and the specifically amendment is trying to tie it to the definition of a TNC and understanding that these network companies exist, they will continue to exist, and at some juncture there will be Ubers and Lyfts and other vehicles out there that are operating without a steering wheel or pedals in the next few decades.
But Bradenton Republican Senator Tom Lee says he wants to make sure that if somebody is injured in an accident, somebody's responsible for helping them recover.
My interest is to make sure that the damaged party, whoever that might be, as a result of the actions of the software or whatever, it certainly wasn't the driver, he wasn't actually driving, he was just there, but that the owner of the vehicle have liability under the financial responsibility provisions of Florida statute. And it is your intent that whatever those financial responsibilities statutes are, that they would apply to the consumer who owns that car, even though that consumer did not actually drive it into somebody. It just did it on its own.
Brandis says as the cars are produced, he expects manufacturers to accept that liability.
You have certain auto manufacturers who have come out and said, look, if we sell you a level 3 car or a fully autonomous car under our definition, we will agree that we were liable for that. And so I'm sure that will be resolved as these companies come out on the marketplace. They're going to have some type of liability protection that goes along with the implementation of the software and hardware system together.
Brandis says if that doesn't happen, he doesn't think the cars will sell well because people would have such serious concerns about liability. But he points out many of these discussions are hypothetical, as the industry is still in the developing stages. The bill has one committee stop left in the Senate. A similar measure in the House is ready for a floor discussion. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Thanks also to Robbie Gaffney and Kevin Del Orbe. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capital Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com, and from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag.